Track 8.
There was only a handful of the ship's depleted crew on deck, and they were lining the rail, wistfully watching the commotion ashore, eager to join the fighting and looting. "Where is the captain?" Tom demanded. "They took him to his quarters." Tom flew down the deck, and when he reached the door to the stern cabin, he came up short as a terrible groan echoed along the quiet deck. He paused with his right hand outstretched, unable to summon the courage to open the door and discover what horrors awaited him on the far side. Abberley reached past him and quietly pushed it open. Tom stared into his father's cabin. They had rigged a wooden grating under the stern windows where the light was strongest. His father was laid on his back upon the grating. Dr. Reynolds stood over him. He wore his black frock coat, his formal operating attire. The thick serge cloth was greenish with age and stiff with old dried blood. Reynolds was already perspiring freely in the hot little cabin. He looked up at Tom and nodded. "Good. Come in, lad. Don't just stand there gawking. I need another pair of strong hands," he said grimly, and began to roll his sleeves above the elbows. Tom advanced on leaden feet until he stood beside the grating and looked down at his father's torn body. The fiery stench of raw spirit filled the heated cabin. One of the two surgeon's mates was forcing the neck of a three-quarters empty bottle of rum into Hal Courtney's mouth. The spirit was running down his cheeks and into his hair. Hal was gagging, and even in his semi-conscious condition, trying to turn away his head. Tom snatched the bottle from the man's hand. "Slowly, curse you for a clumsy oath, you'll drown him." "He needs the rum to get him through the pain," the surgeon's mate protested. Tom ignored him and lifted his father's head as gently as if he were an infant. He gave him the bottle with care, allowing only a sip at a time to trickle between his lips, then waiting for him to swallow. He looked down at the injured legs. Reynolds had buckled leather straps around each one, halfway up the thighs, and twisted these tourniquets to stem the bleeding. But the wounds were still weeping. They had placed a bucket beneath the grating to catch the blood, and the steady drip, drip sounded to Tom like a water clock counting out the seconds of his father's life. Reynolds finished his preparations and selected an ivory-handled scalpel from the canvas surgeon's roll that lay on the grating beside the maimed legs. He began to cut away the ragged, blood-soaked legs of Hal's breeches. Tom blanched and felt his senses swim as the carnage beneath the cloth was revealed. The blast had jellified the flesh, bruised it to the colour of minced liver. Sand and coral chips had been driven into it as though fired from a musket, and splinters of bone stood out of the bloody meat like flint arrowheads. Reynolds palpated the legs. They were soft and boneless in his hands. He pursed his lips and shook his head. "They have to come off. Both of them. I cannot save them." "No," Tom gasped. "You cannot take his legs. He will never again ride a horse or command a ship. You must not do it. Then he will die. His legs will rot, and he will be dead of the gangrene in a week or less if he is lucky." He nodded at his two mates. "Hold him." Abberley stepped forward, and Reynolds said, "Yes, you too. We need strong arms here." He selected a scalpel, which looked to Tom more like a butcher's knife than a surgical instrument, and tested the edge on his own thumb. Tom saw the specks of rust on the blade, where old blood had not been properly scrubbed away. "Master Tom, you will hold his head." Reynolds handed him a wooden wedge. "Keep that between his teeth. He must have something to bite on when the pain hits him, or his teeth will crack." He dipped a sponge into the bowl of hot water that his mate held, and swabbed away some of the blood and dirt from Hal's left leg so that he could see where to make the first cut. Then he gave another twist to the strap of the tourniquet and ran the edge of the blade across the tightly drawn skin. The flesh parted, and Tom, who was holding the wooden wedge between his father's jaws, felt his body convulse and his back arch, every muscle and sinew drawn tight as though by a capstan. A terrible cry issued from Hal's throat. And then he clamped down on the wedge, locking his jaws so that the wood was crushed between his teeth. Tom tried to hold his head as it thrashed from side to side, but his father had the strength of a madman. "Hold him!" Reynolds grunted as he cut down. And Auberly and the men holding Hal were thrown about by the strength of his convulsions. Tom heard the steel of the blade strike the femur deep in his father's thigh. Quickly, Reynolds laid the knife aside and took up the hank of black catgut. He tied off the open ends of the blood vessels, which were running freely despite the tourniquet. The blood cascaded into the bucket beneath the grating. Tom could not believe that there was so much of it. Reynolds picked a saw out of the canvas roll and inspected the fine teeth. Then he seized the shattered leg in his left hand, and like a carpenter dividing a plank, he placed the blade in the deep scalpel wound and made the first stroke. The steel teeth grated shrilly against the bone, and despite the weight of four men trying to hold him down, Hal doubled in the middle and came up into a sitting position. His head was thrown back, and ropes of muscle and ligaments stood proud in his throat and shoulders. Another tortured scream tore out of his gaping mouth and rang through the ship. Then his body went slack, and he fell back limply on the grating. "Thank the Lord for that," Reynolds whispered. "We must work swiftly now before he comes around again." With three more long strokes, the bone parted. The leg sagged, and the surgeon laid aside the saw and picked up the knife again. "I'll leave him a good thick pad on the stump, so that the end of the bone is well covered." He shaped the flesh with a few rapid slices, and Tom gagged as the shattered leg came free and flopped on the grating. One of the surgeon's mates picked it up and dropped it on the deck. It lay there like a fresh-caught cod thrown on the floorboards of a fishing skiff, twitching softly as the nerve ends died. Reynolds threaded a length of catgut through the eye of a sailmaker's needle, then folded the flap of flesh over the exposed bone that protruded from the stump. He hummed in his throat as he probed the point of the needle through the tough skin and began to lay his neat little stitches along the seam. The loose ends of the sutures, with which he had tied off the blood vessels, dangled out of the closed wound. Within minutes, Reynolds stood back and held his head to one side, like a seamstress judging a piece of embroidery. "Nice," he said. "Very nice, even if I say it myself." He made a little clucking sound of self-approval. To Tom, the stump looked like the head of a newborn baby, round and bald and bloody. "Now let's have a look at his other pin." Reynolds nodded at his mate. The man seized Hal's remaining ankle in his big hairy hands and pulled the mangled leg straight. The agony roused Hal from the dark fogs of unconsciousness. He uttered another shuddering groan and struggled weakly, but they held him down. Reynolds examined the leg, starting high on the thigh, just below the tourniquet, then working down over the knee, probing his powerful stubby fingers deep into the flesh to feel for broken bone. "Good," he encouraged himself. "Excellent. I think I can risk cutting much lower here. I will save the knee. That's important. We will be able to articulate a wooden leg. He may even learn to walk again." The thought that his father, who had been the vigorous centre of his existence for as long as he could remember, might never be able to walk again, was suddenly thrust upon Tom's dazed mind. It was almost as unbearable as the horrors he was forced to witness as Reynolds picked up the bloody scalpel and laid the first incision on the remaining leg. Hal bucked and screamed in his sweat-slippery hands and chewed the wooden wedge to splinters. Tom was panting and grunting with the effort of holding the squirming body and fighting back the waves of nausea that threatened to overwhelm him as the second leg fell away and dropped to the blood-slicked deck beneath their feet. This time, Hal had not been granted the release of coma. He had endured every exquisite agony of the knife and the hacksaw. Tom was filled with awe and a strange sense of pride as he watched the way his father fought back against the agony and only succumbed when it soared to another pinnacle. Even then he tried to choke back his cries. At last, Tom could bend over him and place his lips an inch from Hal's ear and whisper,
It's over, Father. It's all over.
Unbelievably, his father heard him and understood. He tried to smile, and that smile was a terrible thing to see.
Thank you.
Howe's lips formed the words, but no sound issued from his tortured throat. Tom's vision swam as tears threatened to overwhelm him, but he forced them back, and then he kissed his father on the lips, something he could not remember doing in all his life. Howell made no effort to roll his head aside to avoid the embrace. Ned Tyler hurried to meet Tom as he stepped out onto the deck.
"How is he?"
he asked. "He is alive," Tom replied. And then, when he saw how real was Ned's concern, he took pity on him. "As well as we can expect. We will not know for some days yet. Dr. Reynolds says that he must rest."
"Thank God for that, at least," Ned said,
then looked at Tom expectantly. For a moment, Tom did not know what he was waiting for. Suddenly he realized. Ned needed orders. He shied away from it. He felt too tired and uncertain of himself to take on the responsibility that was being thrust upon him. Then, with an effort, he rallied his resources. "Our first concern now is to get all our wounded back on board where Dr. Reynolds can attend them properly."
"Aye, Mr. Courtney."
Ned looked relieved and turned away to pass on the orders. Tom was astonished at how easily it had happened. He was no longer Master Tom, but Mr. Courtney. As Hal's son, the mantle of command had passed naturally to him. He was only 17, and he bore no official rank, but this was not a naval vessel, and Tom had proved time and again that he had a level head on his shoulders, that he could hold his own in any fight. The officers and men liked him. It did not have to be debated. If Ned Tyler accepted his right to command, then so would every man aboard the Seraph. He tried to think what his father would want him to do, even though his instinct was to hurry back to Hal's bedside and stay there until he was strong enough to care for himself. But he knew that Dr. Reynolds and his mates were better equipped for the business of nursing him back to health. Thinking quickly, he told Ned to secure the ship and see to the routine details of management. Then he went on. "I leave the ship in your hands, Mr. Tyler." The words he had heard his father utter so often came easily to his lips. "I'm going ashore to take command there."
"Aye, sir,"
Ned replied. With Aboli close behind him, Tom strode back to the fort. Some sort of order had been restored, but he found Anderson and every one of the men still engrossed in ransacking the storerooms of the fortress. A mountain of plunder was piled in the centre of the courtyard, and a wild confusion of men milled about it, adding more bales and boxes to the pile.
"Captain Anderson," Tom hailed him. "There are 300 or 400 of the enemy escaped into the forest. Many of them are still armed. I want the ramparts manned against a counter-attack."
Anderson stared at him incredulously, but Tom went on resolutely. "Please put your best officer in command and have the enemy cannon reloaded with grape and trained round to cover the edge of the forest." Anderson's face started to swell and turn a brighter crimson. Every sailor within earshot had stopped whatever he was doing and now stood idle and gaping, following the exchange avidly. "Then please have the open gateway barricaded to repel an attack," Tom went on. He was as tall as Anderson, and he held his eye without blinking. For a long minute Anderson looked at him, and it seemed that he was on the point of challenging the order. But then he wavered and looked away at the open gateway, at the unprepared rabble of his men. The sense of what Tom had ordered was irrefutable.
"Mr. MacNaughton,"
he roared, unnecessarily loudly, for his mate was only 5 paces from where he stood,
50 men to barricade the gates, and 100 to man the captured guns. Load the grape and cover the approaches to the fort."
He turned back to Tom. "There is only an hour or two of daylight left to us," Tom went on. "We will clear the fugitives out of the forest at first light tomorrow." He looked across at the ranks of naked prisoners who still knelt in the dust. "As a matter of common humanity, I want those people clothed and given water. Then they can be confined in the cells of the fort. How many of our men are wounded?"
"I'm not certain."
Anderson looked guilty. and the red faded slowly from his complexion. "Have your writer draw up the butcher's bill," Tom ordered. "The casualties must be sent on board the ships where they can be attended by the surgeons." Tom looked around quickly and saw that Ben Abram, the Arab surgeon, was still at work attending to the enemy wounded. Someone had had the sense to give him four of the prisoners to assist him. "We will bury the dead tomorrow before they start to poison the air. The Musselmen have certain strict rituals for the disposal of their dead. Pirates that they are, we must honour their traditions." Tom worked with Anderson until long after the sun had set. By the light of burning torches, they restored order, had the fort secured and the booty placed under strict guard. By then, Tom was weaving on his feet with fatigue. The shallow sword wound across his thigh, which Al-Auf had inflicted, burned, and every muscle in his body ached brutally. "It is safe now, Klebby. All is taken care of until tomorrow. You must rest." Abeli was suddenly at his shoulder. "There's still one thing that cannot wait until tomorrow." Tom led the way out through the gates to where Big Daniel still lay. Between them they wrapped the great body in a sheet of canvas, and one of the stretcher parties carried it down to the beach. It was after midnight when Tom staggered down the passage to the Seraph's stern cabin. A surgeon's mate sat beside the bunk on which Hal lay. Tom told him, "I'll take over," sent him away, and threw himself down on the hard deck. Twice during the night his father's groans woke him. Once he gave him the water he pleaded for, and later he held the pewter bowl for him to urinate. It troubled him deeply to see Hal brought so low, to the level of an infant, but the pleasure of being able to serve him outweighed his exhaustion and his pity. Tom woke again before dawn, and thought for a dreadful moment that his father had died during the night, but when he touched Hal's cheek the flesh was warm. He held the steel shaving mirror to his mouth, and with relief watched the shining surface cloud. Hal's breath was still tainted with the odour of stale rum, but he was alive. Tom wanted to stay with him, but he knew that that would not be what his father expected of him. He left him in the care of the surgeon's mate, and before the sun rose went ashore with Abuli. There was still so much work to be done. He placed Master Walsh and the writer from the Yeomen of York in charge of tallying the booty they had captured. Anderson took command of packing the treasure and sealing the chests, which were carried down to the beach and placed in the charge of a trusted officer and an armed guard. Then Tom sent for Ben Abram. The old man looked exhausted, and Tom wondered if he had slept. "I know it is your custom to bury your dead before sunset on the second day." Ben Abram nodded. "You know our customs as well as our language. How many are there?" Ben Abram looked grave. 343 that I have been able to count." "If you give me your parole for their good behaviour, I will release 50 of your men from the stockade to dig the graves." Ben Abraham selected a burial site at the far end of the ancient Islamic cemetery and put his men to work. It went quickly in the soft sandy soil. Before noon they had carried the bodies, each wrapped in a sheet of clean white trade cotton, down from the fort. Al-Auf's headless corpse was in the centre of the long row laid along the bottom of the shallow pit and covered with earth. Ben Abraham recited the Islamic prayers for the dead, and afterwards came to find Tom on the beach. "I call down the blessings of Allah upon you for your compassion. Without your mercy, none of the dead could have entered the Garden of Paradise. One day, may the man who kills you extend to you the same consideration." "Thank you, old father," said Tom grimly. "But my mercy will end with the dead. The living must face the consequences of their crimes." He left the old man and went to where Alf Wilson and Abeli were waiting at the head of 300 fully armed men, who included the prisoners of Al-Auf, whom he had released. "Very well," Tom said. "Let's round up those who escaped from the fort." Tom used the steady wind of the monsoon and sent small groups of men to put fire into the eastern fringe of the forest. It caught readily, and flames roared through the undergrowth in towering clouds of thick black smoke. Those Arabs still hiding in the forest were driven before the fire. When they came running out from among the trees, few had any fight left in them. They threw down their weapons, pleaded for mercy, and were marched away to join their comrades. By nightfall on the second day, almost every fugitive had been rounded up and penned in the stockades of the fort. "The only sweet water on the island is in the rainwater cisterns of the fort," Tom told Anderson, when they met on the beach at sunset. "If we missed any, they will have to give themselves up before noon tomorrow or die of thirst." Anderson studied the boy, who had so swiftly become a man. Tom's face was blackened by the soot of the fires, and there were bloodstains on his shirt, for some of the Arabs had chosen to fight rather than accept the dubious mercy of the Ferengi. Yet, despite the fatigue of battle, there was a commanding set to Tom's shoulders and a new authority in his voice. Anderson noticed that the men responded without hesitation to the orders he gave. "By God," he thought, "the pup has become a fighting dog overnight. He has the manner and look of his sire. I would not like to get on the wrong side of either of them." Without questioning his own subservience, he reported, quite naturally, "The writers have finished the tally of the prize. I warrant it will surprise you, for it did me. The weight of the gold alone is almost 3 lakhs, at a conservative estimate. Please see that it is divided into 4 equal portions, Tom said. "One portion to be sent aboard each of the ships of the squadron, including the Lamb." Anderson looked puzzled. "Surely Sir Henry will want it all under his own eye," he demurred. "Captain Anderson, we have the long voyage back to England ahead of us, with countless hazards of sea and weather to face. If we are unfortunate to lose a ship, it may be the wrong one, and we lose all the gold. If we spread the risk, then we stand to lose only a quarter, and not the whole." "Why the hell did I not consider that?" Anderson thought, but said reluctantly, "They screwed your head on the right way." He'd almost called Tom lad, but that no longer fitted. "I will give the orders, Mr. Courtney. We have 26 of our own men wounded, 5 of them seriously. I want a gang to build comfortable, airy shelters above the beach to house them, and the carpenters to make beds for them. Now, as to our dead," Tom glanced across at the 8 canvas-wrapped corpses lying in the shade of the grove. "I want them taken aboard the Minotaur. We will give them a proper burial at sea. The Minotaur will sail out into the deep water at first light tomorrow. Will you be good enough to conduct the service, Captain Anderson?"
"I will be honoured to do so."
"Now, I will have Mr. Walsh issue a keg of brandy from the Seraph's stores to Aberley, in which to pickle Al-Auf's head." When Tom entered the stern cabin, Hal stirred on the bunk and whispered,
"Is that you, Tom?"
Swiftly, Tom went to kneel beside him.
"Father, it is so good to have you back. You have been unconscious these last 3 days." "3 days? So long. Tell me what has happened since."
"We prevailed, Father, thanks to the sacrifice you made. We carried the fort. Al-Auf is dead. Aberley has his head pickled in a brandy keg, and we have taken a vast treasure from the fort."
"Dorian?" Hal asked.
At that question, Tom felt the joy go out of him. He looked down at his father's face. It was so pale that it seemed to have been dusted with white flour, and there were deep purple half-moons under his eyes.
"Dorian is not here."
Tom's whisper was as soft as his father's. Hal closed his eyes, and Tom thought he had passed out again. They were silent for a long while. When Tom started to rise to his feet, Hal opened his eyes again and rolled his head.
"Where is he? Where is Dorian?"
"Al-Auf sold him into slavery. But I do not know where they took him, except that it must be somewhere on the mainland."
Hal struggled to sit up, but he did not have the strength to lift his shoulders from the mattress. "Help me, Tom,"
Help me to my feet. I must go on deck. I must ready the ship to go after him. We have to find Dorian.
Tom reached out to restrain him, thinking he does not know. He felt a sorrow so deep it threatened to drown him.
How do I tell him? Come, lad, help me up. I'm weak as a newborn foal. Father, you cannot stand. They have taken your legs.
Don't talk nonsense, Tom. You test my patience. His father was becoming so agitated that Tom feared that he might injure himself. Dr. Reynolds had warned that any violent movement might rupture the sutures and start the bleeding again.
They have to convince him, for his own good.
Tom stooped over Hal and drew back the light cotton coverlet from his lower body.
Forgive me, Father. I have to show you.
Very gently, he placed an arm under Hal's shoulders and lifted him until he could look down at his own body. The grotesquely foreshortened limbs lay on the mattress, each swathed in a turban of bandages on which the blood had dried in dirty brown stains. Hal stared at them for a long while, then fell back on his pillows. For a minute, Tom thought he had fainted again, but then he saw tears squeezing from between the tightly closed eyelids. That was too much for him to bear. He could not watch his father weep. He had to leave him now to make his own terms with his destiny. He drew the sheet over him to hide those terrible injuries, and tiptoed from the cabin, closing the door silently behind him. When he came on deck, the longboat was ready to take him across to the waiting Minotaur. Captain Anderson was on the quarter-deck, speaking quietly to Alf Wilson. Tom glanced at the 8 canvas-wrapped bodies. Each one was lying on its own grating, and a large round shot had been sewn into the foot of each shroud. He could recognize Daniel Fisher by his bulk. He dwarfed the others who lay beside him.
Mr. Wilson, kindly get us underway and put the ship on a course to clear the passage.
The Minotaur's black sails were appropriate to this sombre voyage. She left the island and bore out towards the west, while the colour of the water beneath her keel changed from the turquoise green of the shallows to the royal purple of the ocean depths.
Heave the ship to, please, Mr. Wilson.
The Minotaur rounded head to the wind, and Anderson began to intone the sonorous words of the burial service. Out of the deep have I called unto thee. The wind mourned in the rigging, while Tom stood bareheaded by the mainmast and thought of how much he had lost in these last days. A father, a brother, and a dear friend. We therefore commit their bodies to the deep. A sailor was standing by the head of each grating, and at the words they lifted them in unison so that the shrouded bodies slid out over the ship's side and plunged feet first into the sea, drawn swiftly under by the iron shot. Alf Wilson nodded to the gunners standing by their cannon, and the first shot of the salute crashed out in a long spurt of silver gun smoke.
Goodbye, Big Danny. Goodbye, old friend, Tom whispered.
Later that evening, Tom sat beside his father's bunk, and in a low voice reported the day's events to him. He was not certain that Hal could yet understand everything he told him, for he made no comments and seemed to drift in and out of consciousness. However, talking to him made Tom feel closer to him in spirit and helped to assuage the loneliness of command, the onerous burden of which he was coming to know for the first time. When Tom at last fell silent and was about to go to his pallet on the deck, Hal fumbled for his hand and squeezed it weakly.
"You're a good lad, Tom," he whispered. "Probably the best of all of them. I only wish..."
He broke off and let Tom's hand slide from his grip. His head rolled to the side, and he snored softly. Tom would never know what it was he had wished. Over the next few days, Tom noticed a slight improvement in his father's strength. He was able to concentrate for more than just a few minutes on what Tom had to report to him before he slumped into unconsciousness. Within a week, Tom was able to ask him for advice and receive a reasoned reply.
However, when he consulted Dr. Reynolds as to when his father would be strong enough to begin the return voyage to England, the doctor shook his head. "I'll be able to remove the sutures from his legs in 3 days' time. That is 14 days from the amputation. If you sail in a month from now, you will still be subjecting him to severe risk, especially if we run into heavy weather. To be safe, we should wait at least 2 months. He needs time to build up his strength."
Tom went to find Anderson and found him supervising the final loading of the heavy cargo they had captured. This was mostly spices and cloth, including magnificent silks from China.
"Captain Anderson, I have discussed with my father the question of the Arab prisoners."
"I hope he does not think of releasing them. They are pirates, plain and simple. They have murdered hundreds of honest seamen."
"We could never countenance releasing them," Tom agreed. "Apart from any other consideration, it would set a dangerous precedent. We cannot let loose such a pack of tiger sharks to prey upon the sea lanes."
"Yes, I'm pleased to hear that," Anderson grunted. "The Rope's End should be their final destination."
"By the last count, we have 535 of them. That's a great deal of rope, Captain Anderson, and I doubt we have enough yardarms on which to hang all of them out to dry."
Anderson sucked his pipe as he thought about the logistical problems of executing so many men.
"On the other hand, they would be worth at least £30 a head on the slave block, perhaps more," Tom pointed out.
Anderson stared at him, his blue eyes popping. He had not thought of that.
"God's blood, they deserve it. But you cannot sell them in Zanzibar," he said at last. "The Sultan would never let you put muscle men up for sale in his markets. We would have another war on our hands."
"The Dutch have no such qualms," Tom said. "They are always on the lookout for slaves to work their cinnamon plantations in Ceylon."
"You are right," Anderson chuckled with delight. "It's a round voyage of 5,000 miles to Ceylon and back again, but the winds are fair, and at £30 a head it will be well worth the detour."
He did a quick mental calculation. "Sweet heavens, that's within spitting distance of £16,000. He was silent again as he worked out his own share of that amount, then grinned.
"Ha ha! Allah oof had sufficient slave chains stored in the fort to accommodate all his own men quite handsomely. That has a fine touch of justice to it."
"According to Dr. Reynolds, my father will not be well enough to sail for at least 2 months. I propose that you should load the captives on board the Yeoman and convey them to Colombo. When you have sold them to the VOC governor there, you will rejoin us here. In the meantime, I will send the captured dhow south to summon the Lamb from where she is lying in the Glorietta's. We will make the return voyage to England in convoy. With fair winds and God's grace, we can drop anchor in Plymouth Hoe before Christmas." The following day they loaded the Arabs on board the Yeoman. The blacksmiths from all the ships were needed for the work of riveting the leg irons onto the ankles of the long ranks of men. They were chained in batches of 10, then led down to the beach. Tom was with Reynolds in the thatched hospital they had set up under the palm trees. He was visiting the wounded sailors lying there, hoping to give them a little cheer and encouragement. 2 had already died when their wounds mortified and turned into the dreaded gas gangrene. But 4 had recovered sufficiently to return to their duties on board ship, and Reynolds was optimistic that the others would soon follow them. Tom left the hospital and paused to watch the batches of prisoners shuffling past on their way to the waiting longboats. He felt a certain squeamishness at the thought that he was sending these men into a life of captivity. The Dutch were not famous as the gentlest of jailers. He remembered the tales his father, Big Daniel, and Aberley had told of their own experiences in the fort at Good Hope under their Dutch captors. Then he consoled himself that the decision had not been his alone. His father had concurred and signed the warrant for their transportation. Under the powers granted him by the Royal Commission, while Captain Anderson had been positively delighted with the prospect of turning a fair profit on their sale. They were blood-smeared pirates, after all. When he thought of little Dorian, condemned to the same fate, any pity he had felt for the prisoners withered. Anyway, he had argued with his elders, and convinced both his father and Anderson to exempt the women and children of the garrison from the sentence of transportation into slavery. There were 57 of these unfortunates, some of them infants only months old.
Many of the women were heavily and obviously pregnant. Touchingly, five had elected to follow their husbands into captivity rather than suffer separation. The others would be kept here on Flor de la Mar until suitable transport to Zanzibar could be arranged for them. He was about to turn away when the familiar face and silver beard of Ben Abraham among the prisoners caught his eye. "Bring that man to me," he called to the guards, who pulled him out of the ranks and dragged him to where Tom stood. "A pox on you," Tom reprimanded them. "He is an old man. Treat him gently." Then he spoke to Ben Abram. "How is it that a man like you was with Al-Auf?" Ben Abram shrugged. "There are sick to be tended everywhere, even among the outlaws. I never ask of a man's good deeds or of his crimes when he comes to me to be healed." "So you treated the Ferengi prisoners of Al-Auf as well as the true believers?" Tom asked. "Of course. That is the will of Allah the Compassionate." "You cared for my brother? You gave him comfort?" "He is a winsome boy, your brother. I did what I could for him." "But Allah knows it was not as much as I could have wished," Abram said. Tom hesitated slightly before he countermanded his father's orders, but then he reached a decision. "You have earned your freedom for that. I will send you back to Zanzibar with the women and children." He turned to the guards. "Have this man's chain struck off, then bring him back to me. He is not to be transported to Ceylon with the rest of these blackguards." When Ben Abram returned, free of his chains, Tom sent him to help the surgeon's mates in the makeshift thatch roof hospital. Laden with her human cargo, the yeoman sailed with the following dawn, and Tom watched her from the beach until she disappeared below the eastern horizon. He knew that Anderson was optimistic in thinking he could make the long voyage across the Indian Ocean to Ceylon and return to Flor de la Mar within 2 months. "The longer he takes, the more time for father to grow strong again," Tom whispered as he closed the telescope and called for the longboat. As soon as Tom entered the stern cabin, he realized that his father was worse than when he had left him only hours before. There was the sour smell of sickness in the cabin, and Hal was flushed, restless. Once again, he had relapsed into delirium. "There are rats crawling on my body, black rats, hairy," he broke off and screamed, and struck out at things Tom could not see. In a panic, Tom sent the longboat back to the island to fetch Dr. Reynolds. Tom bent over Hal and touched his face. The skin was so hot that he jerked away his hand in surprise. Abberley brought a bowl of cool water, and they stripped back the sheets from Hal's emaciated body, from which the fever had burned the flesh. As they exposed the stumps of his legs, the stench of corruption rose in a thick cloud, strong enough to make Tom gag. "Tell the doctor to hurry," he bellowed, and heard his order relayed to the approaching longboat. Abberley and Tom bathed the fever-hot body and laid wet cloths over Hal's trunk to try to reduce his temperature. Tom was relieved when at last Reynolds came down the passage and hurried to Hal's side. He unwound the bandages. Immediately the stink in the small hot cabin was stronger. Tom stood behind him and peered in horror at the stumps of his father's legs. They were swollen purple-red, and the stitches of black catgut were almost hidden in the puffy flesh. "Ah," Reynolds murmured, and leaned forward to sniff the wounds like a connoisseur nosing a fine claret. "They have ripened very prettily. At last I can pluck the sutures." He rolled up his sleeves and called for the pewter bowl. "Hold it like that under the stump," he told Tom. "Hold him down," he ordered Abberley, who leaned over Hal and took his shoulders gently in his huge hands. Reynolds took a firm hold of the end of one of the strings of catgut that hung out between the pursed crimson lips of the wound, and tugged at it. Hal stiffened and screamed, and the sweat burst out across his forehead in a white rash. The black string came free and slithered out of the wound, followed by a gush of greenish-yellow pus, which dripped thick as cream into the pewter bowl. Hal dropped back on the pillows in a dead faint. Reynolds took the bowl from Tom and sniffed the vile effluent again.
Lovely. It's benign. Not a taint of gas gangrene to it.
While Tom knelt at his side, he plucked out the other sutures, one at a time, from the inflamed, swollen flesh. Each had a tiny piece of yellow detritus, the remains of the decayed blood vessel caught in the knot at the end. He dropped them into the bowl. When he had finished, he rebandaged the stumps with fresh white cotton strips.
"Should we not wash the legs first?" Tom asked diffidently.
Reynolds shook his head firmly.
"We will let them heal in the pus. It is safer to let nature take its own course, without interference," he said sternly. "Your father's chances of survival are now very much improved, and within another few days I'll be able to remove the main stitches that are holding the flaps of the stumps."
That night his father rested much easier, and by the morning the heat and inflammation of his wounds had abated considerably. 3 days later, Reynolds removed the remaining stitches. He snipped the black threads with a pair of scissors and used ivory tweezers to pull the last remaining pieces of catgut from the tormented flesh. Within days thereafter, Hal was able to sit up with pillows propped behind his back and to take a keen, intelligent interest in the reports Tom gave him of events.
"I have sent the captured Dows south to the Glorietta's to fetch the lamb. She should rejoin the squadron within 2 weeks at the latest," Tom told him.
"I shall be relieved when we have her and that fat cargo of tea once more under our guns," Hal said. "She's very vulnerable, lying down there unprotected."
Tom's estimate was accurate, and it was exactly 14 days later that the two vessels, the small dhow and the matronly lamb, sailed through the pass in the reef and dropped anchor once more in the lagoon of Flor de la Mar. Tom had Mustafa, the captain of the dhow, and his terrified crew brought down from the cells in the fort where they had been imprisoned since their capture by the Minotaur. When they were paraded before him, they fell on their knees before him in the white beach sand, fully believing that the hour of their execution had come at last.
"I do not believe you are guilty of piracy," Tom said to calm their fears. "As Allah is my witness, what you say is the truth, exalted one,"
Mustafa agreed fervently and touched the sand with his forehead. When he looked up again, his forehead was dusted with the white grains, like a sugared bun.
"I am setting you free," Tom reassured him. "But I make only one condition. You must take certain passengers back with you to the port of Zanzibar. The chief of these is, like you, an honest man and a son of the Prophet. There are also the women and children who were with Al-Auf when we captured the island."
"The blessings of Allah upon you, wise and compassionate one," Mustafa genuflected again, and tears of joy streamed down into his beard.
"However," Tom cut short this show of gratitude, "there is no doubt in my mind that you came here to trade with Al-Auf, and that you knew full well what the goods he offered were, the plunder of a pirate, and that they were besmirched with the blood of innocent men."
"I call on God to witness that I did not know," Mustafa cried passionately.
Tom cocked his head on one side and looked heavenwards for a minute. Then he said dryly,
"God does not seem to answer your call. Therefore I will fine you the amount of 65,000 gold dinars, which is, by a remarkable coincidence, exactly the sum we found in your chest when we searched your ship." Mustafa wailed with horror at such terrible injustice, but Tom turned away and told the guards,
"Release them. Give them back the dhow and let them go. They will take all the women and children. The Arab physician Ben Abraham will go with them too, but send him to me before he goes aboard the dhow."
When Ben Abram came, Tom led him away to the end of the long white beach so that they could make their farewells in privacy.
"Mustafa, the owner of the dhow, has agreed to take you to Zanzibar when he sails."
Tom gestured across the water of the lagoon to where the small ship lay at anchor.
"He is taking the women and children from the garrison on board now."
They watched the refugees being ferried aboard, clutching their infants and pathetic bundles of their possessions. Ben Abram nodded gravely.
"I offer you my thanks, but Allah will write your true reward against your name. You are young,
but you will grow up to be a man of power. I have seen you fight. Any man who can overcome Alauf in single combat is a warrior indeed." He nodded again as he considered that feat of arms. "The manner in which you have treated those weaker than yourself, the widows and orphans, shows that you temper your strength with compassion, and that will make you great." "You are also a man of great heart," Tom told him. "I have watched you work with the sick and wounded, even those who do not follow the teachings of your prophet." "God is great," Ben Abram intoned. "In his sight we are all worthy of mercy. Even the young children."
"Especially the young children," Ben Abraham agreed.
"That is why, old father, you are going to tell me those things concerning my brother that so far you have kept from me."
Ben Abraham came up short and stared at Tom, but Tom returned his gaze steadily, and Ben Abraham dropped his eyes.
"You know the name of the man who bought my brother from Al-Auf," Tom insisted. "You know his name."
Ben Abraham stroked his beard and looked out to sea. Then, at last, he sighed.
"Yes," he said quietly, "I know his name. But he is a mighty man, of royal blood. I cannot betray him. That is why I have concealed his name from you, even though I have sympathy for your loss."
Tom was silent, allowing the old man to wrestle with his conscience and his sense of duty. Then Ben Abram said,
"You already know the man's name."
Tom stared at him, puzzled.
"You captured one of his dhows," Ben Abram prompted him.
Tom's expression cleared.
"Al-Malik," he exclaimed. "Prince Abd Muhammad Al-Malik."
"I did not say the name," said Ben Abram. "I did not betray my prince."
"So, a lakh of rupees that was on board the dhow of Al-Malik was indeed the payment for my brother, as we suspected," Tom asked.
"I cannot say if that is true," Ben Abram ruffled his silver beard. "But neither can I say that it is false."
"Both my father and I believed that was so, but I could not understand how Dorry could be gone from Flor de la Mar before the payment arrived on the island. I cannot believe that Alauf would trust anyone with such a valuable slave as Dorry without receiving full payment first."
The old man replied, "The prince is the most powerful man in Araby, save only for his elder brother, the caliph himself. Al-Malik cannot count his ships and his gold, his warriors and his camels, his slaves and his wives. His fame spreads from the mighty river Nile and the deserts of the north, east to the kingdom of the great Mogul, west to the forbidden forests of Africa, and south to the land of the Monomotapa."
"You're saying that Al-Auf trusted him with the debt of a lakh of rupees?" Tom demanded.
"I am saying that Al-Auf trusted no living man, but Prince Abd Muhammad Al-Malik."
"When you leave here, Ben Abram, will you return to Lamu, where Al-Malik is the governor?"
"I will return to Lamu," the old man agreed.
"Perchance you will see my brother again?"
"That is in the hands of God."
"If God is kind, will you give a message to my brother?"
"Your brother is a boy of great beauty and courage."
Ben Abram smiled at the memory.
"I called him my little red lion cub. Because of the kindness you have shown me and because of the affection I have for the child, I will carry your message to him.
Tell my brother that I will be true to the dreadful oath I swore to him. I will never forget that oath, not even on the day of my death."
Dorian sat on a mattress on the stone floor. The only air in his cell came through the narrow loophole opposite him. It was a faint eddy of the monsoon that reached him and kept the heat bearable. When he listened, he could hear the sounds of prisoners in the other cells along the passage, their muttering broken at intervals by outbursts of abusive shouting at their Arab guards and bitter argument among themselves. They were like dogs confined in cages too small for their numbers, and in the oppressive heat these naturally aggressive, violent sailors became murderous. Only yesterday he had heard the sounds of a terrible conflict, and of a man being strangled to death in the next cell, while his mates cheered on the murder. Dorian shuddered now and reapplied himself to the task he had chosen to while away the monotony of his captivity. He was using a link of his leg irons to scratch his name into the wall. Many others who had been confined in the cell had left their marks carved into the soft coral blocks. "Perhaps one day Tom will find my name here and know what happened to me," he told himself as he rubbed away at the stone. His captors had put the chains on him only the previous morning. At first they had left him unfettered. Then yesterday they had caught him trying to wriggle out through the narrow loophole in the far wall. Dorian had not been daunted by the 30-foot drop below the opening, and he had succeeded in forcing the top half of his small body through it before there had been cries of alarm behind him. His jailers had seized his ankles and dragged him back into the cell. They held him while he struggled like a fish on a hook.
"Al-Auf will have no mercy on us if the infidel puppy injures himself. Bring the slave chains."
A blacksmith had altered the fetters to fit his small ankle.
"Make certain that the iron does not gall him. Al-Auf will kill the man who marks his white skin or harms one red hair on his head."
Apart from the leg irons, they treated him with consideration and respect. Every morning, despite his struggles, two veiled women took him down to the courtyard. They stripped him and oiled his body, then bathed him at the rainwater cistern. On board ship, Dorian had gone for months at a time without bathing. There was no fresh water for such extravagance, added to which all seamen knew that too much washing reduced the natural oils of the skin and was bad for the health. The Mussulmen were strangely addicted to these excesses of personal cleanliness. Dorian had watched them wash 5 times a day before they went through the ritual of their prayers, so even though it threatened his health, he had to resign himself to this daily ordeal by water. He even grew to welcome the break in the dreary routine of his captivity, and had more trouble each time in rousing his temper to register his protests. Occasionally he made a rather half-hearted attempt to bite one of the women, especially when they handled the more intimate parts of his anatomy. Soon, though, they were ready for this, and avoided his attacks while shrieking with laughter. They exclaimed endlessly over Dorian's hair as they fondled, combed, brushed, and coiled it into thick, shiny ropes. They had replaced his noisome, tattered rags with a clean white robe. In every other way, too, they took good care of him. They had placed a soft, beautifully tanned sheepskin over the palm fronds of his mattress. They had given him a silk pillow for his head and an oil lamp to light the long hours of the night. There was always a water jar within his reach, and the evaporation through the porous clay kept the contents cool. The women fed him 3 times a day, and although at first he had vowed to starve himself to death simply to spite them, the aroma of the food they offered him was too tempting for his young appetite to resist. Although his solitary existence was hard to bear, he knew that he should be grateful that he had not been placed in the crowded cells further along the passageway. He had been warned by both his father and Tom about what could happen to a pretty little boy if he were placed at the mercy of vile, depraved older men. His chain was just long enough for him to reach the step below the loophole, and though he could climb up and look out through the tiny window, he could not repeat his previous escape attempt. When he was not busy carving his name into the wall, he spent hours gazing out over the lagoon where Al-Auf's fleet was anchored. He longed for even a glimpse of the white topsails of the Seraph over that distant blue horizon. "Tom will come," he promised himself each dawn, as he searched the lightning ocean. Each dusk he watched until the horizon receded into the wine-purple shades of night, and he bolstered himself with the same words. "Tom promised, and he always keeps his promises. He will come tomorrow. I know he will." Every few days, his jailers came to take him down to Ben Abram. The Mussulman doctor had named Dorian Lion Cub, which had stuck. His jailers were as wary of his temper as the women, and handed him over to Ben Abram with relief. The doctor examined him carefully from the top of his shining head to his bare feet, for any sign of neglect or abuse. He was especially concerned that the leg irons had not marked his white skin, and that he'd been properly fed and attended to.
"Are they treating you well, little Red Lion cub?"
"No, they beat me every day,"
Dorian replied defiantly,
"and they burn me with red-hot irons."
"Are they feeding you well?"
Ben Abram smiled kindly at this patent lie.
"They give me worms to eat and rat's piss to drink."
"You are thriving on that diet," Ben Abram remarked. "I should try it myself."
"My hair is falling out," Dorian contradicted him. "Soon I will be bald, and then Alaouf will send you to the execution ground."
Dorian was aware of the peculiar value that the Mussulmen placed on his hair. But the older man had fallen for his threat of baldness only once. Now he smiled again and ruffled the luxuriant tresses.
"Come with me, my bald lion cub."
He took Dorian's hand, and for once the boy did not try to pull away. In his aching loneliness, which he tried so hard to conceal, Dorian was drawn irresistibly to the kindly old man. He went along with him to the audience chamber where Al-Auf was waiting. There was a ritual to these gatherings in which Dorian was displayed to the latest prospective buyer. While they argued and haggled, inspected his hair and his naked body, Dorian stood rigid, staring at them with a scowl of theatrical fury and hatred, silently composing the most foul insult his increasing command of Arabic afforded him. Always there came the moment during the negotiations when the buyer asked, "But does he speak the language of the Prophet?" Then Al-Uf would turn back to Dorian and order, "Say something, child." Dorian would draw himself up and let fly with his latest composition.
"May Allah blacken thy face and rot the teeth in thy cursed jaws," or "May he fill thy bowels with worms and dry the milk in the udders of all the goats whom thou hast ever taken to wife."
There was always consternation among the prospective buyers at these sallies. Afterwards, when Ben Abraham walked him back to his cell, he would reprimand Dorian primly. "Where did such a beautiful child learn such evil words?" But his eyes would twinkle merrily in their webs of wrinkles. But on the final occasion when he entered the audience chamber, Dorian was aware of a different atmosphere. The man to whom he was being shown was not some rough Dhow captain or fat oleaginous merchant. He was a prince. He sat in the centre of the floor on a pile of silk cushions and rugs. Yet his back was straight and his mien was regal. Although a dozen attendants sat behind him in attitudes of fawning subservience, there was no arrogance in the man. His dignity was imperious and his presence monumental. In the family Bible at High Weald there was a picture of St. Peter the Rock. The resemblance of this man to him was so striking that Dorian thought that they must be the same person. He was overcome with religious awe. "Greet the mighty prince Al-Malik," Al-Awuf insisted. When Dorian stood speechless before the reincarnation of Christ's apostle, evidently Al-Auf was nervous of Dorian's reaction to this command, for he tugged anxiously at his beard.
"Show the prince respect, I will have you thrashed," he urged.
Dorian knew that the threat was baseless. Al-Auf would never mark him and spoil his value. He continued to stare at the man before him in awe.
"Make your salams to the prince," Al-Auf urged him.
Dorian felt his rebellious instincts shrivel in the presence of this man. Without conscious thought, he made an obeisance of deep respect. Al-Auf looked startled and decided to press this unexpected advantage. He hoped that the boy would eschew any reference to female goats or rotting teeth.
"Speak to the exalted prince. Greet him in the language of the prophet," he commanded.
Without having to think about it, Dorian recalled an exercise Alf Wilson had set them during a long afternoon on the afterdeck when the Seraph had lain becalmed in the doldrums. He'd been trying to explain the similarities between Islamic and Christian beliefs. Now, in his sweet, unbroken voice, Dorian recited from the Quran,
"I am but a man like yourselves, but the inspiration has come to me that your God is one God. Whoever expects to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness."
There was a sharp intake of breath from every man in the chamber. Even the prince leaned forward quickly and stared raptly into Dorian's clear green eyes. Dorian was delighted with the sensation he had created. He had always enjoyed the theatrical performances Master Walsh had arranged at High Weald and on board ship, when Dorian had usually been cast as a woman. However, this was undoubtedly his most acclaimed performance. In the long silence, the prince straightened slowly and turned to the man who sat immediately behind him. Dorian saw by his dress that he was a mullah, a religious leader, the Islamic equivalent of a priest. "Expound on the child's words," the prince ordered. "It is verse 110 of Surah 18," the mullah admitted reluctantly. His face was round and glossy with good living, and a pot belly bulged onto his lap. His straggly goatee beard had been dyed a faded orange with henna. "The child has quoted it accurately, but even a parrot can be trained to mouth words he does not understand." The prince turned back to Dorian. "What do you understand by righteousness, child?" Alf Wilson had prepared him for that, and Dorian did not hesitate. "It is the true respect for God, which shuns the worship of idols or deified men, or the forces of nature, or especially of one's own self."
Al-Malik turned back to his mullah. "Are those the words of a parrot?" he asked.
The holy man looked discomfited. "They are not, my lord. They are wise words indeed."
"How old are you, child?"
Al-Malik fixed Dorian with his dark, piercing gaze.
"I am 11, almost 12," Dorian told him proudly.
"Are you of Islam?"
"I would rather my nose were eaten away with leprosy," Dorian replied. "I am a Christian."
Neither the prince nor the mullah showed shock or anger at such a vehement denial. They, too, would have rejected any suggestion of apostasy as strongly.
"Come here, boy,"
Al-Malik ordered, not unkindly, and Dorian stepped closer to him. He reached out and took a handful of Dorian's freshly washed, glistening hair. Dorian submitted patiently as he ran it through his fingers.
"Thus must have been the very hair of the prophet," he said softly.
Every man in the room echoed, "Praise be to God!"
"You may send him away now," Al-Malik told Al-Auf. "I have seen enough, and we must talk."
Ben Abram took Dorian's hand, and they went to the door.
"Guard him well," Al-Malik called after them, "but treat him gently."
Ben Abram made the gesture of respect and obedience, touching his lips and his heart, and led Dorian back to his cell. Al-Auf's servants brought fresh pots of coffee. While one recharged the prince's tiny cup of pure gold with the tarry thick brew, another relit his hookah. The bargaining for such a momentous purchase could not be hurried. Gradually, with long, pregnant pauses and elaborate exchanges, expressed in poetic, flowery phrases, the two men moved closer to an agreement. Al-Auf had doubled his asking price to 2 lux in order to give himself latitude within which to manoeuvre, and gradually allowed himself to be beaten down. It was long after dark when, by the light of the oil lamps and in the fragrant smoke of the pipe, they reached agreement on the slave price for the child.
"I do not travel with so much gold in my ship," Al-Malik said. "I will take the child with me when I sail on the morrow, and I will send a fast dhow back to you as soon as I reach Lamu. You will have your luck before the rise of the new moon, my sacred oath on it."
Al-Auf barely hesitated. "As the great prince decrees."
"Leave me now, for the hour grows late and I wish to pray."
Al-Auf rose immediately. He had relinquished his own quarters to Al-Malik, for he was honoured to play host to such an exalted guest, and as he backed towards the door, he made a series of deep genuflections. "May the Uris of Paradise attend your dreams, great prince.
May your awakening be perfumed with the scent of violets, mighty one.
May your prayers fly like gold-tipped arrows straight to the ears of Allah, O beloved of the prophet." Dorian could not sleep. The sense of elation he had experienced after his meeting with the prince had long since evaporated and left him frightened and lonely once more. He knew that yet again his circumstances had changed, and that he was about to be thrown on dark, uncertain waters. Much as he hated his present dreary captivity, it was something to which he had grown accustomed, and there were small consolations in his present position. He had grown to like and depend upon the old Arab doctor. Ben Abraham was a friendly face, and Dorian sensed he had his interests at heart. Also, while he was on this island, there was always a chance that his father and Tom would be able to follow the trail that led to him. If he were to be taken off to some other place by this fearsome prince, what chance then that they would still be able to track him down? He was too afraid to blow out the flame of the oil lamp, although it attracted the mosquitoes to his tiny cell, and preferred to scratch rather than lie awake in the dark. Below the walls of the fort, the palm fronds clattered softly in the unrelenting winds of the monsoon. He hugged himself and listened to the mournful sound of the wind, fighting back the temptation to give in to his tears. Then he heard a different sound on the wind, so light that at first it did not quite penetrate the dark mists of his misery. It died away, then came back stronger and more clearly. He sat up and reached for the lamp. His fingers were trembling so that he almost dropped it. He stumbled across the cell to the step below the loophole and came up at the full stretch of his chain. He placed the lamp on the sill and listened again. There was no mistake. Somebody was whistling softly down there at the edge of the forest, and as he recognised the tune, his heart leapt and soared. "It's Tom!" He wanted to scream it aloud, and he strained against his chain to reach the opening. He tried to sing the next line of the song, but his voice broke and his lips were numb with excitement. He gathered himself and tried again, pitching his voice so softly that it would not carry to the guards at the end of the passage or to the watchmen on the ramparts of the fort above him. "We'll rant and we'll roar all over the wild ocean. We'll rant and we'll roar all over the wild seas." The whistling out there in the night broke off abruptly. He strained his ears but heard no more. He wanted to call out, but knew it might alert someone, so held his tongue, though it burned in his mouth like a live coal. Suddenly there was a scrabbling sound close outside the loophole, and Tom's voice, "Dorry! Tom! Oh, I knew you would come. I knew you'd keep your promise." "Shh, Dorry, not so loud. Can you climb out through the window?" "No, Tom, I'm chained to the wall." "Don't cry, Dorry, they'll hear you." I'm not crying." Dorian stuffed his fingers into his mouth to muffle the sounds of his weeping. Tom's head appeared in the opening of the window. "Here!" Dorian gulped back the last sob and reached with both hands through the loophole. "Give me your hand!" Tom struggled to force his way through the tiny opening, but at last fell back. "It's no good, Dorry." Their faces were only a foot apart. "We'll have to come back for you." "Please don't leave me here, Tom," Dorian begged. "The Seraph is waiting just offshore. Father Abberley and I, we are all here. We will be back for you soon." "Tom!" "No, Dorry, don't make so much noise. I swear to you we'll come back for you."
"Tom, don't leave me alone, Tom!"
His brother was going. He could not bear it. Dorian pulled desperately at his arm, trying to force him to stay.
"Let go, Dorry, you'll make me fall."
Then there was a shout from the battlements above them, and a voice cried out in Arabic, "Who is it? Who is down there?"
"The guards, Dorry. Let me go."
Suddenly Dorian felt his brother's arm torn from his grip, and at the same time there came the roar of a musket shot from close above their heads. He knew his brother had been hit, and he heard his body slide down the wall, then with a terrible thump hit the ground far below.
"Oh no, please God, no!"
Dorian cried. He tried to put his head through the loophole far enough to see if his brother was truly killed, but the chain held him back. There was a chorus of shouts and a wild fusillade of musket fire from the top of the walls. Quickly confusion spread through the garrison. Within minutes he heard Arab voices at the foot of the wall below his window. "There is nobody here," someone shouted up at the guards on the ramparts above Dorian's head.
"I know I hit him," the guard shouted down. "He must be there." "No, there is no one here, but I see the marks where he fell."
"He must have escaped into the forest."
"Who was it?"
"A Frank. His face was very white in the moonlight." Their voices receded into the forest, Then Dorian heard more shouting and musket fire, and the sound of men blundering about among the trees. Gradually the noises receded into the distance. Dorian stood by the loophole for the rest of that night, waiting and listening. But slowly the last sparks of hope flickered out, and when the grey dawn at last lit the bay and the ocean beyond, and there was no sight of the Seraph, only then did he creep back to his sheepskin and bury his face in the silk pillow to stifle his sobs and to soak up his tears. They came to fetch him at noon. The two women who had taken care of him were weeping and wailing at the prospect of losing their charge, and when the jailer unlocked his leg iron, he said gruffly, "Go with God, little monkey. There will be nobody here to make us laugh when you are gone." Ben Abraham took him down to where Al-Auf waited for him, hands clasped angrily on his hips, beard bristling with rage. "What Frankish dogs were those that came sniffing around your kennel last night, puppy?" he demanded. "I know nothing of this." Although he still felt bereft and tearful, Dorian put on a show of defiance. "I was sleeping, and I heard nothing in the night. Perhaps the devil sent you evil dreams." He would never betray Tom to them. "I do not have to accept your impudence any longer." Al-Auf stepped closer. "Answer me, you seed of Satan. Who was at the window of your cell? The guards heard you talking to the intruder." Dorian stared up at him silently, but he was gathering a ball of spit under his tongue. "I am waiting," Al-Auf told him menacingly, and lowered his face until their eyes were only inches apart. "Wait no longer," Dorian said, and spat his mouthful into Al-Auf's face. The pirate recoiled in astonishment. Then a terrible rage distorted his features, and he whipped the curved dagger from his belt. "You will never do that again," he swore. "I'll have your infidel heart for it." As he started his stroke, Ben Abram leapt forward. For a man of such age, he was quick and agile. He locked both hands on Al-Auf's knife wrist. Although he did not have the strength to stop the stroke, he deflected it from Dorian's chest. The glittering point of the dagger snagged in the sleeve of his white robe and left a clean rent in the material. Al-Auf staggered back, thrown off balance by the unexpected attack. Then, almost contemptuously, he threw the old man to the ground. "You will pay for that, you ancient fool." He stepped over him. "Lord, do not harm the child. Think of the prophecy and of the gold," Ben Abram pleaded, and seized the hem of Al-Auf's robe. The corsair hesitated. The warning had touched him. "A luck of rupees to lose," Ben Abram insisted, "and the curse of Saint Tam-Tam upon your head, if you kill him." Al-Auf stood uncertainly, but his lips twitched and his knife hand trembled. He stared at Dorian with such hatred that at last the boy's courage failed, and he shrank back against the wall. "The spittle of an infidel. It is worse than the blood of a swine. He has defiled me." Al-Auf was whipping up his faltering anger. He started forward again, then froze, as a peremptory voice boomed across the chamber. "Stop! Put down that knife! What madness is this?" Prince Al-Malik towered in the entrance to the chamber. Summoned by the shouting and the uproar, he had come through from the sleeping quarters at the back. Al-Auf dropped the dagger and prostrated himself on the stone flags. "Forgive me, noble prince," he blubbered. "For a moment, Shaitan stole my wits. I should send you to visit your own execution field," Al-Malik said coldly. "I am dust in your sight," Al-Auf whimpered. "The child is no longer your property. He belongs to me. I will atone for my stupidity in any way you wish, only do not turn the face of wrath upon me, great prince." Al-Malik did not deign to reply, but looked at Ben Abram. "Take the child down to the lagoon at once, and have him placed on board my dhow. The captain is expecting his arrival. I will follow presently. We will sail with the high tide this very night." Two of the prince's men escorted Dorian down to the lagoon, and Ben Abram walked with him, holding his hand. Dorian's face was pale, his jaws clenched hard in the effort to maintain a brave face. They did not speak until they reached the beach, and the skiff from the Royal Dhow was waiting to take Dorian out to where she lay at anchor. Then Dorian begged Ben Abram, "Please come with me." "I cannot do that," the old man shook his head. "Just as far as the Dhow, then, please. You are the only friend I have left in the whole world." "Very well, but only as far as the Dhow." Ben Abram climbed into the boat beside him, and Dorian moved up close beside him.
"What will happen to me now?" he asked in a whisper.
Ben Abram replied gently, "Whatever is the will of God, my lion cub."
"Will they hurt me?
Will they sell me to some other person?" "The prince will keep you beside him always," Ben Abraham reassured him.
"How can you be so certain?"
Dorian laid his head on Ben Abraham's arm. "Because of the prophecy of Saint Time-Time. He will never let you go. You are too valuable to him."
"What is this prophecy?"
Dorian sat up again and looked into his face. "Everyone speaks of the prophecy, but nobody tells me what it is." "It is not the time for you to know." Ben Abraham drew the child's head down again. "One day it will be made clear to you."
"Can't you tell me now?"
"It might be dangerous for you to know. You must be patient, little one." The skiff bumped against the side of the dhow. Men were waiting to receive Dorian.
I don't want to go," he clung to Ben Abraham.
"It is the will of God." Gently, the old man disentangled Dorian's fingers. The sailors reached down and lifted him onto the deck.
"Please stay with me a little longer,"
Dorian said imploringly, looking down into the small boat. Ben Abraham could not refuse the appeal. "I will stay with you until you sail," he agreed, and followed Dorian down to the small cabin that had been set aside for him. He sat beside him on the mattress and reached into the pouch on his belt.
"Drink this."
He brought out a small green glass vial and proffered it.
"What is it?"
"It will soften the pain of our parting and make you sleep." Dorian drank the contents of the vial and pulled a face.
"It tastes awful."
"Like rat's piss?" Ben Abraham smiled. And Dorian burst out in laughter that was close to a sob and hugged him.
"Now lie down."
The old man pushed Dorian back on the mattress, and for a while they talked together quietly. Then Dorian's eyelids began to droop. He had not slept at all the night before, and his weariness and the drug soon overpowered him. Ben Abraham stroked his head for the last time.
"Go with God, my child,"
he said softly, rose from the mattress, and went on deck. The clumping of feet above his head and the movement of the howl through the water as the dhow got under way woke Dorian. He looked around for Ben Abraham, but found him gone. Instead, a strange woman was squatting on the deck beside his mattress. In her black robe and veil, she looked like a roosting vulture. Dorian stood up groggily and staggered to the small porthole in the cabin. Outside it was dark, and the stars were dancing on the waters of the lagoon. The sweet night air blowing into his face revived him and cleared his mind a little. He wanted to go up on deck, but when he turned to the doorway, the woman stood up and barred his way.
"You must not leave here until the prince calls for you."
Dorian argued with her for a while, but then gave up the futile effort and returned to the porthole. He watched the walls of the fort glide by, glistening white in the moonlight, as the dhow left the lagoon and threaded its way through the channel. Then he felt the deck surge under his feet at the first strong send of the ocean. As the ship turned towards the west, his view of the moonlit island was cut out. He jumped down from the porthole and threw himself on the mattress. The black-veiled woman went to the porthole and closed the heavy wooden shutter over it. At that moment, the lookout on the deck just above Dorian's head shouted so suddenly that Dorian jumped.
"What boat are you?"
"Fishing boats, with the night's catch," came the answer. The reply was faint, almost inaudible, with distance and the closed shutter over the porthole. But Dorian's heart leapt against his ribs, then raced away with excitement.
"Father!"
he gasped. Although the voice had spoken in Arabic, he had recognized it instantly. He flung himself across the cabin and tried to reach the window, but the woman seized him.
"Father!"
he screamed, as he wrestled with her. But she was heavily built, with big breasts and a full, soft belly, and although she was fat, she was powerful. She caught him round the chest and threw him back onto the mattress.
"Let me go!" he screamed at her in English. "That's my father! Let me go to him!"
The woman lay on top of him with her full weight, pinning him down.
"You cannot leave the cabin," she grunted. "It is the command of the prince."
Dorian wrestled with her, but then froze, as from out there in the night his father hailed the dhow again. "What boat are you?" His voice was growing fainter. The dhow must be pulling away fast. "The ship of the Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik," the lookout called back, his voice strong and clear. "Go with Allah!" Hal's voice was so faint and far away that it came as a whisper to Dorian's ears.
"Father!"
he yelled with all his strength. But the woman's weight was pressing on his chest, smothering him.
"Don't go! It's me, it's Dorry!" he cried in despair,
because he knew that his muffled cry could never carry from the closed cabin across the water to his father's ear. With a sudden twist and heave, he threw off the big woman and slipped out from under her. Before she could hoist her bulk to her feet, he had darted to the cabin door. As he struggled with the lock, she lumbered at him. He just managed to throw open the door as her fingers hooked into the collar of his robe. He threw himself forward with such force that the cotton ripped and he wriggled free. Dorian shot up the companionway with the woman hard after him, screeching at the top of her voice,
"Stop him! Catch the infidel!"
An Arab seaman was waiting for Dorian at the top of the stairs and blocked his way with outstretched arms. But Dorian dropped to the deck and, quick as a ferret, wriggled between his legs. He raced down the deck towards the stern. He could see the dark shape of the longboat from the Seraph moving across the slick waters of the dhow's wake, pulling away swiftly towards the island, the oars swinging and dripping phosphorescence from their blades. A figure stood tall in the stern. Dorian knew it was his father.
"Don't leave me!"
His voice was small in the night. He reached the stern rail and jumped onto it, gathering himself to dive overboard into the dark waters. But a strong hand closed on his ankle and dragged him down. Within seconds, he was covered by the weight of half a dozen Arab crewmen. They carried him back down the companionway, kicking, biting and scratching, and pushed him into the cabin.
"If you had jumped into the sea, they would have thrown me after you to be eaten by the fish," the fat old woman complained bitterly. "How can you be so cruel to me?"
She huffed and fussed, and sent to ask the captain to post two men outside the cabin door. Then she made certain the shutter over the porthole and the cabin door were both securely barred to prevent another escape attempt. Dorian was so distraught and exhausted that when he fell asleep at last, it was as though he was still drugged. It was almost midday when she woke him.
"The prince has sent for you," she told him, "and he will be angry with old Tahi if you are dirty and smelly as a kid goat."
Once again he submitted to being bathed and having his hair combed and dressed with perfumed oil. Then he was led to the pavilion on the foredeck of the dhow. A roof of canvas shaded the area from the scorching tropical sun almost directly overhead, but the sides of the tent-like structure were raised to let the cool winds of the monsoon blow through. The deck had been covered with silk rugs, and the prince reclined on a slightly raised dais on a bed of cushions, while the mullah and four others of his personal retinue sat cross-legged below him. They were in deep discussion when Dorian was brought to them, but al-Malik gestured them to silence as Tahi brought the child to stand before him. She prostrated herself on the deck, and when Dorian refused to follow her example, she tugged at his ankle.
"Show respect for the prince," she hissed at him, "or else he will have you beaten."
Dorian was determined to resist her order. He set his jaw and raised his eyes to stare into the prince's face. After only a few seconds, he felt his determination waver, and he dropped his eyes. Somehow he found it impossible to defy this regal person. He made the gesture of respect.
"Salaam alaikum, Lord," he whispered,
and prostrated himself. Al-Malik's expression remained stern, but little laughter lines crinkled around his eyes. "And peace unto you also, Al-Ahar-Mara." He beckoned Dorian to come closer, then indicated a cushion below his dais, close to his right hand. "Sit here, where I can stop you jumping over the ship's side, when next the Cafard, the madness, overtakes you." Dorian obeyed without protest, whereupon the men ignored him and continued with their discussions. For a while, Dorian attempted to follow their conversation, but they spoke swiftly and in a formal manner that tested his understanding to the limits. Their talk was full of the names of men and places of which he was ignorant. One place name he recognized, though, was Lamu. He tried to orientate himself and conjured up in his mind's eye the charts of the Fever Coast that he had been made to study so often during his navigation lessons with Ned Tyler. Lamu was several hundred leagues north of Zanzibar. It was a smaller island, and from what he remembered of the sailing orders in his father's logbook, it was another major trading port and centre of government of the Omani Empire. He could tell by the wind direction and the angle of the afternoon sun that the dhow was on an approximately northwesterly heading, which would indicate that Lamu was probably where they were heading. He wondered what fate awaited him there, then craned his neck to look back over the stern. There was no sign of the Flor de la Mar on the horizon behind them. During the night they must have run the island under and severed all contact with the Seraph, his father and Tom. At the thought he felt again that enervating mood of despair, but determined not to let himself capitulate to it. He made another effort to follow the discussions of the prince and his retainers. "Father will expect me to remember everything they say. It could be very valuable to him in making his plans," he told himself. But just then the mullah stood up and went to the bows. From there he began the call to prayer, in a high, quavering voice. The prince and his men broke off their discussions and made preparations for the midday worship. Slaves brought ewers of fresh water for the prince and his retinue to wash. In the stern the helmsman pointed up into the north, indicating the direction of the holy city of Mecca, and every man aboard who could be spared from the running of the dhow faced that way. In unison, following the plaintive cries of the holy man, they performed the ritual of standing, kneeling, and prostrating themselves on the deck, submitting themselves to the will of Allah and offering him their devotions. This was the first time Dorian had been caught up in such an efflorescence of devotion. Although he sat apart from it, he felt himself strangely moved by its force. He had never felt the same way during the weekly services in the chapel at High Weald, and he followed the chanting and the exhortations with a keener interest than their local clergyman had ever evoked in him. He looked up towards the heavens, into the vast blue bowl of the African sky, filled with the cloud ranges marching ahead of the monsoon winds. In religious awe, he imagined he could see in the eddies of silver cloud the beard of God and his terrible features adumbrated in the shapes and outlines of the thunderheads. Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik rose from his position of prostration and stood erect on the low dais, still facing towards the holy city, crossing his hands over his breast in the final expression of his devotion. Dorian looked up at his bearded face and thought that perhaps God looked like that, so noble, so terrifying, and yet so benign. The dhow was running before the monsoon, her huge lateen sail filled tight and hard as a waterskin. The single boom was carved from joined lengths of some dark, heavy tropical timber, almost as thick as a man's waist, and longer in all than the dhow herself. Its full weight was held aloft on the stubby mast by the main halyard. As the dhow rolled to the swells, the shadow of the boom swung back and forth across the deck, alternately shading the prince's regal figure, then allowing the full brilliance of the tropical sunlight to pour down upon him. He stood to his full height under the swinging boom. The Arab helmsman's attention was diverted, and he allowed the bows of the ship to come up too far into the eye of the wind. The sail jarred and creaked ominously. Dorian had been taught by Ned Tyler that the lateen sail was notoriously fickle and unstable in any real blow of wind. and he could sense the ship's distress at the rough handling to which she was being subjected. From the corner of his eye he noticed a sudden change in the sail shadow cast across the deck below the dais. His eyes flickered up into the rigging, and he saw the main halyard begin to unravel just below the heavy wooden sheave block. The rope untwisted like a nest of mating serpents, as one after the other the strands gave way. Dorian stared in horror. For precious seconds, too appalled to move or cry out, he had watched the boom being lowered and trained around when the dhow was tacked, so he knew what a vital role the main halyard played in the lateen rigging. He started to rise to his feet, still staring up at the single mast, but as he did so, the last strand of the halyard parted with a crack, like a pistol shot. With a rush and roar of canvas, the boom hurtled down from on high, half a ton of heavy timber, swinging towards the deck like the stroke of an executioner's blade. The prince was oblivious to everything but his religious devotions, and stood directly under the falling boom. Dorian threw himself forward, shoulder first, into the back of Al-Malik's knees. The prince was taken completely unprepared, balancing himself in the contrary direction to meet the ship's movement. He was thrown off the raised dais, face downward onto the deck. The piles of rugs and cushions strewn across the timbers broke his fall, and Dorian's small body landed on top of him. Behind them, the hardwood boom crashed through the roof of the low deckhouse, shattering it into a heap of broken planking and raw splinters. The great baulk of timber snapped at the splice, and the forend whipped down, gaining velocity as it struck the foredeck. It crushed the low wooden dais on which, moments before, the prince had been standing, smashed through the bulwarks of the bows, and stove in most of the deck planking. The single lateen sail ballooned down behind it and covered the foredeck, smothering the men lying there under its stiff canvas shroud. The dhow's motion altered drastically as she was relieved of all the pressure of her canvas. Her bows fell off into the wind, and she began to roll viciously and wallow in the swells of the monsoon. For long seconds there was silence on board, except for the banging and clattering of loose tackle and sundered rope ends. Then there came a chorus of startled shouts and the screams of injured men. Two sailors on the after deck had been crushed and killed instantly, and three others were terribly mutilated, limbs shattered and bones crushed. Their cries were pitifully thin in the wind. Under the shouted orders of the dhow captain, the unhurt sailors rushed forward to hack away the tangle of ropes and canvas that covered the men on the foredeck. "Find the prince!" the captain shrieked, fearful for his own life if his master were hurt, or, Allah forbid, killed, under the massive weight of the boom. Within minutes, they had ripped away the folds of the sail, and with exclamations of relief and expressions of thanks to God, lifted him out from under the wreckage. The prince stood aloof in the pandemonium, ignoring the rapturous cries of thanks for his deliverance, and surveyed the remains of his dais. The boom had even sheared through the thick silk folds of the precious prayer rug on which he had been standing. The mullah rushed down the deck to his side. "You are uninjured. Thanks be to Allah. He spread his wings over you, for you are the beloved of the Prophet." Al-Malik fended off his hands and asked, "Where is the child?" The question triggered another frantic search under the mountains of canvas. At last they dragged Dorian out and stood him in front of the prince. "Are you hurt, little one?" Dorian was grinning with delight at the devastation that surrounded them. He had not enjoyed himself so much since he had last been with Tom. "I am fine, sir." In the excitement of the moment, he had lapsed into English. "But your ship is fairly buggered." Tom knew that the men must be kept busy during the days and weeks that they had to wait for the return of Anderson from Ceylon. Idle seamen soon find mischief with which to occupy themselves. They become a threat to themselves and to each other. He also realized that for his own well-being and peace of mind he must find solace in work. Otherwise he would spend the long tropical days brooding on Dorian's fate and his father's terrible injuries and slowly deteriorating state of health. He found himself torn between these two conflicting loyalties. He knew that as soon as Hal was fit to travel, he must try to get his father home to the peace and security of High Weald, where he could be nursed back to health by English surgeons and cared for by a staff of loyal servants. On the other hand, this would mean leaving Dorian to his fate as a slave in an alien world. He felt the irresistible force of his oath to his brother summoning him towards that awful coast that was Africa. He went to Aberley to help him resolve this dilemma. "If my father would let me take command of the Minotaur and gave me a small crew of good men, then you and I could go after Dorian. I know where to start searching for him. Lamu."
"Then what of your father, Klebby? Are you ready to desert him, now that he needs you most? What will you feel when the news reaches you, when you are somewhere out there?"
Aberley pointed to the west, where the mysterious continent lay beneath the horizon.
"That your father is dead, and that perhaps you could have been there to save him." "Do not even speak of it, Aberley."
Tom flared at him, then subsided with a sigh of uncertainty.
"Perhaps by the time Captain Anderson and the yeomen return, my father will be strong enough to make the voyage home without us. I will wait until then before I decide. But in the meantime, we must get the Minotaur ready for any call we make upon her."
Despite the work already done on her, she still showed the effects of her sojourn at the hands of Al-Auf, and they both knew that her hull was probably heavily infested with shipworm, the curse of tropical waters. That very day, Tom ordered her to be careened. He had never had to do this before, and knew he must rely heavily on the expertise of Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson. The ship was unloaded of all her cargo and heavy gear, including her cannon and water barrels. All this was ferried to the beach and stored under thatched lean-to shelters in the palm grove, and the guns arranged to protect the camp. Then the lightened hull was warped in parallel to the beach on the high spring tide. Lines were run through heavy sheave blocks from the top of all three masts to the shore, and secured to the largest, strongest palms above the beach. Then, with 3 fathoms of water under her hull, the Minotaur was hove over. 20 men on each of the capstans, and the rest of the men on the shorelines, strained and chanted and heaved. Gradually the ship took on a heavy list to starboard, and her planking on the opposite side was exposed until she was in danger of rolling clean under. But by this time the tide was in full ebb, and the Minotaur settled on the sandy bottom with her entire port side exposed. Before the tide was fully out, Tom and Ned Tyler waded out to inspect her planking. The Minotaur had been in these waters for almost 4 years, and her bottom was foul with weed and barnacles. Although these would affect her speed and sailing characteristics, they would not threaten her existence. However, when they scraped away the weed, they found what they had most feared. Everywhere, shipworm had bored their holes into the timbers of the hull below the waterline. Tom was able to thrust his forefinger full length into one of these burrows and feel the worms squirm at his fingertips, touching it. In some places, the holes were so close together that the wood resembled a Swiss cheese. The carpenters had iron vats of pitch boiling over fires on the beach. Ned poured a ladleful, bubbling, into one of the wormholes. The loathsome creature came writhing and twisting in its death throes out into the open. It was as thick as his finger, and when Tom seized its head and held it up as far as he could reach, the red serpentine body hung down as far as his knees.
"The old lady would never have made it back home with this filthy crew aboard," Ned told him. "Her owl would have broken up in the first real gale she ran into."
With an expression of disgust, Tom flung the parboiled worm far out into the lagoon, where a shoal of small silver fish churned the water white as they devoured it. The carpenters and their mates came wading out to join them in the work of ridding the hull of these vermin, and kept at it until the tide turned and the rising water drove them back to the beach. They worked through 5 successive low tides to scrape off the weed and shellfish, then cooked out the worms and plugged their holes with pitch and oakum. Those planks that were riddled and rotten past saving were cut out and replaced with bright new timbers. The scoured bottom was painted with a thick coat of pitch, covered with a mixture of pitch and tallow, then another 2 coats of pitch before Ned and Tom were satisfied. With the next high tide, the Minotaur was floated off, and in deeper water turned around. Then she was brought back to the same spot on the beach, and the whole process was repeated, but this time with her starboard side rolled uppermost. When, finally, she was brought back to her moorings in the deeper waters of the lagoon, the topmastman went aloft to send down her yards. These were carefully examined, and any weak spot was repaired before being sent aloft again. Next, all the lines and sheets of her rigging were minutely inspected, and the greater part replaced with fresh manila of the finest quality from the Seraph's stores. The old black sails were in rags and tatters. Most had been roughly patched and cobbled by Alaouf's men. "We will replace them all," Tom decided, and sent Ned to rifle the lockers of the Seraph. The sailmakers squatted in rows on the open deck, making up new canvas and altering the sails from the Seraph's lockers to suit the Minotaur's masts and yards. The lower decks were in the same state of degradation as the Minotaur's rigging. She was lousy with vermin and rats, and stank like a dung heap. Ned concocted a fearsome brew of gunpowder, brimstone, and vitriol, and they placed pots of this in the lower decks and set them alight. As the noxious smoke and fumes billowed from the pots, they hurried out onto the deck and into the fresh air. Then they battened down all her ports and hatches and let the smoke seep into every corner and cranny of the hull. Within minutes, the rats began to desert the ship, wriggling out through the hawse hole and every crack in the gun ports. Some were as big as rabbits as they swam frantically for the beach. The crew had great sport shooting at them with pistol or musket and wagering on the bag. When the hull and the rigging had been taken care of, Tom turned his attention to the paintwork. This was faded and peeling. They rigged cradles over her sides, and teams of men sanded her down, then gave her 3 coats of gleaming white down to the waterline. In a transport of artistic zeal, Tom had them pick out her gun ports in a gay sky blue, and regild the horned figure and the carvings of the stern gallery. After 6 weeks of unrelenting work, the Minotaur looked like a ship just off the builder's slip. Her lovely lines and her sweet sheer were displayed to full advantage. Looking across at her from the stern windows over his sick bed, Hal Courtney smiled wanly with approval. "By Jesus, she's as pretty as a bride on her wedding day. Well done, my boy. You have added £5,000 to her value." His father's words gave Tom the courage to make a request. Hal listened quietly as he asked for the Minotaur and an independent command. Then he shook his head. "I have lost one son," he said softly. "I am not yet prepared to lose another, Tom. But, Father, I gave Dorry my sacred oath." Shadows of terrible pain, worse than those he had undergone on the grating when they took his legs, passed behind Hal's eyes. "I know, Tom, I know," he whispered. "But the Minotaur is not mine to give you. It belongs to John Company. Even that would not stop me if I thought we could help your brother. But I cannot give you the ship and let you go off into terrible danger without a full crew to help you." Tom opened his mouth to argue further, but Hal reached up from the rumpled sickbed on which he lay and placed his hand on his son's arm. "Listen to me, lad." His voice was husky, and the pale, bony hand on Tom's arm was light as the wing of a bird. "I cannot let you go alone. This Al-Malik is a man of power. He commands armies and hundreds of ships. On your own, you will not prevail against one such as him." "Father!" Tom broke in again, but his father stopped him. "Hear me out, Tom. We must see through this voyage together. I have a duty to my king and to the men who placed their trust in me. When we have discharged that duty, I will have you inducted into the order. You will become a Knight Templar of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, with all the power that gives you. You will be able to call on the assistance of your brother knights, men like Lord Childs and Lord Hyde." "That will take a year," Tom cried, in physical pain at the prospect. "No, it may take 2 or 3 years."
We will achieve nothing by rushing in unprepared against a powerful nobleman in a far country, a country that is alien and where we have no allies or influence.
Years, Tom repeated. What will happen to Dorry in the meantime?
By then I will be recovered from these wounds. Hal looked down at his pitiful, truncated legs. We will sail together to find Dorian, you and I, in a fleet of fine, powerful ships manned with good fighting men. Believe me, Tom, this is Dorian's best chance, and ours.
Tom stared at his father, aghast. Since his injury, Hal Courtney had turned into a frail old man, with silvering beard and crippled body. Did he truly believe that he would ever again command another squadron or fight another battle? It was a forlorn dream. Tom felt the tears rising behind his eyes, but forced them back.
Trust me, Tom, Hal murmured. I give you my word. Will you give me yours?
Very well, father.
Tom had to summon all his courage to make the oath, but he could not deny his own father.
I give you my word. Thank you, Tom.
The hand dropped from Tom's arm, and Hal's chin drooped onto his chest. His eyes closed, and his breathing was so soft that it was inaudible. With a flare of dismay, Tom thought he had lost him. Then he saw the gentle rise and fall of Hal's wasted chest. Tom rose from the bedside and moved towards the door, walking softly so that he did not disturb his father's sleep. The monsoon died away, and they lay for months in the torpid grip of the great calm between the seasons. Then the palm trees stirred their fronds, and the clouds turned back upon their tracks across the heavens and marched away in the opposite direction. These two mighty winds are the great wonder of all the oceans of the Indies, Alf Wilson told Tom as they sat on the foredeck. He spoke in Arabic, for Hal still insisted that Tom practice this language every day, and Tom knew that it would stand him in good stead in his quest to find his brother. From November to April they blow out of the northeast, and the Arabs call them the Kaskazi, Alf went on. From April to November they turn back upon themselves and blow out of the southeast. Then the Arabs call them the Kuzi. It was the Kuzi that had brought Captain Edward Anderson back to Flora del Mar in the bright dawn of another windswept day. While the crews of the other ships of the squadron manned the yards and lined the rails to cheer her in, Anderson brought the yeomen of York through the passage in the Coral and dropped anchor alongside the Seraph. Hardly had the ship snubbed up to her cable than Tom sent the longboat across to fetch Anderson to see his father. Edward Anderson came up the ladder looking mighty pleased with himself and his accomplishments, but his first words were to inquire after Hal Courtney's health.
My father makes a strong recovery from his wounds, Tom gave him the white lie, and I am most grateful for your concern, Captain Anderson.
He led Anderson to the stern cabin. Tom had seen to it that the linen on the bunk was freshly washed and ironed, and that Hal's hair had been trimmed and combed by the surgeon's mate. He was propped up on bolsters and looked healthier than he really was.
"I give thanks to God to see you in such fine fettle, Sir Henry," Anderson greeted him and took the chair beside the bunk to which Hal pointed.
Tom served them each a glass of Madeira.
"Do you wish me to leave you alone with Captain Anderson, Father?" he asked as he handed the twist-stemmed glass to Hal.
"Of course not," Hal told him quickly, then said to Anderson, "My son has taken command in my stead while I am indisposed."
Tom stared at him. This was the first time his promotion had been mentioned.
However, Anderson showed no surprise.
"He does you credit, Sir Henry."
"Enough of our doings here on the island," Hal tried to sit higher, but pain stabbed him. He winced and lay back on the pillows. "I am eager to have a report of your exploits since we parted."
"All my news is good." Anderson was neither shy nor reticent. "The outward voyage to Ceylon was accomplished without mishap, and the loss of only a dozen of the captives. Van Grote, the Dutch governor in Colombo, was courteous in his reception and most amenable in his desire to trade. It seems that our timing was most propitious,
as a recent epidemic of smallpox in his barracoons had reduced his population of slaves most drastically. Fortunately, I had been apprised of this prior to opening negotiations with him, so I was able to agree with him a very satisfactory price.
How much?
£37 a head. Anderson looked smug.
My felicitations, Captain Anderson.
Hull reached out to shake his hand.
That is considerably more than we expected.
The good news does not end there, Anderson chuckled. The smallpox plague and the predations of Al-Auf in these oceans meant that Van Grota had been unable to ship much of the last 2 years' cinnamon crop. His warehouses were filled to overflowing. Anderson winked. Instead of taking a note on the VOC bankers in Amsterdam for the sale price of the slaves, I loaded my ship with bales of cinnamon at these bargain prices. I have no doubt that we will double our investment when we reach the Pool of London again.
Again, I must commend your good sense and acumen.
Anderson's news had visibly cheered Hull. Tom had not seen his father look so keen and vigorous since his injury.
The wind stands fair for good hope. We should sail as soon as you are ready to take your yeoman back to sea, Captain Anderson. When will that be?
I have a few cases of scurvy among my crew, but I expect them to recover quickly now that we are in harbour. I need only replenish my water barrels and take on a load of coconuts. I'll be ready to sail within the week. 4 days later, the squadron weighed anchor and tacked out through the passage in line astern. As soon as they reached the open sea, they set all plain sail and headed down into the south to pass through the Mozambique Channel and forge on to the South Cape of the African continent. For the first few weeks, the weather remained fair and the wind favourable. Hull's health responded favourably to being at sea again in the fresh airs and to the kindly motion of the Seraph. He spent time each day rehearsing Tom in the rites of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, preparing him for his entry into the knighthood, and expressed pleasure at his son's progress. After the first week, Tom ordered a daybed set up on the deck, on the weather side of the quarterdeck, and had his father carried up and laid where he could once again feel the wind and sun on his face. Although Tom took full responsibility for the running of the ship, he made time each day to be with his father. During these days, Tom felt himself growing closer to Hull than he ever had been before. Often their talk turned to Dorian and their plans to find and rescue him. They discussed Guy and his marriage to Caroline Beatty only once. To Tom's astonishment, his father spoke to him as to a man full grown. "You do realize, Tom, that the child might well be yours and not Guy's."
"That had occurred to me."
Tom hid his embarrassment as well as he was able, and answered as forthrightly as his father had broached the subject.
"I fear you have made an enemy of your twin brother. Be wary of Guy. He does not forgive an injury, and he has an endless capacity for hatred."
"I doubt we shall ever meet again. He is in India, and I, well, I shall be at the ends of the oceans."
"Fate plays us shabby tricks, Tom,
and the oceans may not be as broad as you think." The squadron made its southings, and at 43 degrees south latitude swung up onto a westerly heading to make the landfall on the tip of Good Hope. Soon they saw the surf beating white on the southern cliffs of Africa. That same day, Hull summoned Tom to the stern cabin and showed him the record of his promotion entered in the ship's log.
"Apart from a demonstration of the trust I have in you, Tom, this also means that you will be entitled to an officer's share of the prize," his father told him. "That might be as much as £1,000.
"Thank you, father."
"There is much that I would do for you that is beyond my powers. William is my firstborn, and you know the significance of that. Everything goes to him. You need not worry about me. I can make my own way in the world."
"Of that I am sure," Hull smiled and gripped his arm. He was stronger now than when they had left Flor de la Mar. Tom could feel the power in his fingers, and the sun had put new colour in his cheeks. "It must be because we have doubled the Cape and are northward bound that my thoughts turn once again to High Weald. Do not hate your elder brother, Tom."
"It is not I who hate him, father.
It is Black Billy who hates me. That contemptuous name betrays your true feelings for him. But when I am gone, he will be the head of our family, and he has a right to your respect and loyalty. It was you who taught me, Father, that respect and loyalty have to be earned, and not demanded. They anchored well off the beach of the little Dutch settlement at the Cape of Good Hope. They watered and revictualled with fresh vegetables and meat, and had neither truck nor bother with the Dutch administration ashore. Within the week they were on their way northwards once more. As suddenly as the squadron entered the Atlantic Ocean, the character of the waters changed, and Hal Courtney's health with it. The Cape Rollers came marching down upon them, great grey ridges of water with deep valleys between, to batter the squadron day and night. The seas creamed over the ship's bows and tore away any weak plank or fitting from the deck. The howl of the wind was the voice of this wolf pack, and the onslaught was merciless and unrelenting. Each day Hal grew weaker again, and when Tom entered his cabin one gale-driven morning, he found his father flushed and sweating. His nostrils flared as he detected the familiar stench of corruption in the air, and when he drew back the bedclothes, he found telltale stains of yellow pus on the white linen. He shouted to the watch above to call Dr. Reynolds, who came immediately. He unwrapped the bandages from Hal's left leg, and his kindly features crumpled with dismay. The stump was horribly swollen, and the lips of the freshly healed wound were hot purple and splitting open with pus oozing from the edges. "I am afraid there is a deep corruption in the wound, Sir Henry." Dr. Reynolds sniffed at the pus and pulled a face. "I do not like these humours. There is the taint of gangrene in them. I must lance the wound at once." While Tom held his father's shoulders, the surgeon pressed the point of a long scalpel deeply into the wound as Hal writhed and whimpered with the pain. When Reynolds withdrew the blade, it was followed by a copious gush of yellow and purple pus, stained with fresh blood that covered the bottom of the bowl the surgeon's mate held under the stump. "I think we have drained the source of the evil." Reynolds looked pleased with the quantity and colour of the discharge. "Now I will bleed you to reduce the fever." He nodded to his mate. They rolled back the sleeve of Hal's nightshirt and wound a leather thong around his upper arm. When they twisted it tight, the veins on the inside of Hal's elbow stood proud like blue ropes beneath the pale skin. Reynolds cleaned the pus and blood from the blade of the scalpel by wiping it on his sleeve, then tested the point and the ball of his thumb before pricking the swollen vein and watching the dark red blood dribble into the pewter bowl to mingle with the yellow pus. "A single pint should be sufficient," he muttered. "I think now we have drained off the morbid humours, though I do say it myself, that's as good a job as you'll see this side of Land's End." Over the following weeks of the voyage, Hal's strength fluctuated widely. For days he lay wan and inert in his bunk, seeming on the point of death. Then he would rally strongly. When they crossed the equator, Tom was able to have him taken on deck again to enjoy the hot sunshine, and Hal talked eagerly of home, longing for the green fields and wild moorland of High Weald. He spoke of the books and papers in his library. "All the logbooks of your grandfather's early voyages are there. These I can leave to you, Tom, for you are the sailor in the family, and they will be of little interest to William." Thinking of Sir Francis made his mood swing again, and he was saddened. "Your grandfather's body will be waiting for us at High Weald, for Anderson sent him back from Bombay. We will lay him in his sarcophagus in the crypt of the chapel. He will be glad to be home again, as glad as I will." His expression was tragic as he thought about it. "Tom, will you see to it that I have a place in the crypt? I would like to lie with my father and the three women I have loved. Your mother..." He broke off, unable to continue. "That day is still far off, Father," Tom assured him with a desperate edge to his voice. "We still have a quest to undertake. We exchanged oaths. We have to go after Dorian. You must get well and strong again.